This is Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from our newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. An eclectic range of stories this week, from a quilt museum to new water guidelines, a pricey new drug dog, and the Confederate flag. Let's start with the Virginia Quilt Museum, celebrating its 20th year with a new executive director. WMRA's Scott Lowe took a tour.
The Virginia Quilt Museum is different than other tourist attractions because, as the new executive director of the museum, Kimberly McCray, explains, so many of us have a personal connection to quilts. In the past, they were functional, durable, and driven by a need for comfort and warmth.
But now more and more quilts are made just to be hanging on the wall and actually be seen as works of art. So there's that dual function of, oh, this is art, something very special, beautiful techniques. But also, I can relate to this because I have this on my bed at home.
And beauty is in the eye of the beholder. There are many ways to see what a beautiful quilt has to offer.
Viewing the quilt and appreciating it visually as a piece of art, just like you would in any art gallery. But then we also really are trying to push more and more towards a scholarly view of quilts here at the museum. So this could be women's studies, rural life, folk art, even industrialization, you know, the change from making quilts purely by hand to nowadays mostly using sewing machines.
McCray, previously the director of the nationally recognized Port of Plymouth Historic Museum in eastern North Carolina, earned degrees in history from both the University of North Carolina and James Madison University. She's originally from Augusta County. The Quilt Museum, which grew out of an original collection that had been housed at the Belgrove Plantation, is now in its 20th year. It's a private nonprofit that takes no federal or state funding. Operating funds come from memberships and sponsorships of events, sponsorships of quilts that are on display, raffles of quilts, special events, and gift shop sales. Every 3 months, the exhibits on each of the museum's three floors are completely changed, with quilts culled from the permanent collection of about 300 quilts, donations, and loaned quilts, as well as antique and toy sewing machines.
This is Virginia. We have quilts 200-300 years old. And of course, think about the size of Virginia in the past. We stretched at one point all the way to the Mississippi River.
Gloria Kraft Comstock is the curator and registrar of the museum. She's responsible for proper display and care of the quilts, as well as getting the story behind the piece. And she can't name a favorite. Why?
Because you can describe a quilt by its intricacy, or you can describe it by the tiny little stitches that the quilt maker made. You can describe it by the total aesthetic, or you can describe it by the history.
So what makes a quilt come alive to me is the color.
Catherine Genovici articulates the striking beauty evident from the very moment one enters this hidden jewel of Harrisonburg.
The one we're standing in front of has among the most vibrant color schemes I've ever seen. There's bright burning orange, there's scarlet, there's purple, there's dark blue, there's lime green, there's sparklies, there's silk.
As the new director of a popular area tourist attraction, Kim McCray is curious about the museum's visitors and where they come from.
We do get some regular locals, but a lot are just passing through the valley, and they find out about us from Massanutten or from a local publication. In fact, yesterday we had two visitors from Nova Scotia, and most people that come here do have some sort of interest in quilting already. They're quilters, their mother's a quilter, etc. But we also get people who are just, I've never been to a quilt museum, I've never even heard of a quilt museum. Let's check this out.
While Kim, her staff, and volunteers strive to preserve the history and culture of quilting at the museum, its success is probably best measured by the enthusiastic response of visiting patrons like Anne from Washington State.
Well, I'm a quilter, and I like history, and of course I love the Civil War. I love any kind of textiles, and I love just going to things like this, so it's very unique. And I love the house and the history, too, so yeah. I want a job here. Can I get a job?
For WMRA News, I'm Scott Lowe.
We're approaching practice time for football season, and athletes practicing in the heat are often encouraged to drink lots of water. But as Carol often reported this week, new guidelines suggest that's not necessarily a good idea.
In the United States, accidental death from overhydration, called exercise-associated hyponatremia, is just as common as death from dehydration. UVA physician Dr. Mitchell Rosner said the problem is that athletes are often encouraged to drink as much as they can during athletic activities, regardless of how thirsty they are. drinking more water than the body needs, can cause an imbalance in the internal salt-to-water ratio.
When you have an excess of water over salt, that leads to cells in our body swelling. Especially worrisome is the cells in the central nervous system in the brain. When that happens, it can cause confusion, seizures, and in the extreme death.
These events are still rare. Current literature cites symptomatic hyponatremia as occurring in less than 1% of the athletic population, and then occurring most often for athletes participating in endurance events. Rosner says in most cases, what he and the other experts found is that preventing hyponatremia is as simple as listening to your own thirst mechanism.
Thirst is an evolutionarily conserved mechanism that works. It'll signal when your body is low on water and you need to drink. When your thirst goes away, that's a sign that you don't need to drink anymore. So that's the safest, easiest way to do this. You can't give anybody a blanket statement like drink a liter per hour or drink 8 cups per hour, because everybody is a little bit different in terms of how much sweat they lose, what the activity may be, and it just doesn't work.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
You'll find lots more details about those guidelines at WMRA.org. Now to Buena Vista, where the police department, despite being under some severe financial strain, has just devoted $46,000 to a drug-sniffing dog. Jesse Nadler has the story.
Sergeant Mitchell Harrison has been a cop in Buena Vista for 15 years, and he really loves dogs.
We thought that would help the community and the surrounding areas. It's something that I've wanted for a long time. I've had a desire to be a canine officer for some time, and the opportunity fronted itself, and I took it.
The opportunity he refers to is grant money from the Virginia Attorney General's office that became available as a result of a multi-million dollar Medicaid fraud settlement in 2012. Local police departments were invited to apply for some of the money to fund such things as new bulletproof vests, cop cars, and in the case of the BVPD, a new drug dog. The department received a check from the state for $46,000 in April. Why so much? Well, a four-legged drug sniffer isn't cheap. The dog itself cost $10,000.
It's $9,945 to be exact. The canine's coming from Tar Heel Canine out of Sanford, North Carolina. This dog's going to have several different capabilities. He'll be able to do some search and rescue stuff as well as, you know, narcotics and things. You know, the $10,000 is a lot of money for a dog, but that includes the dog, the trainer's school, the handler school.
That's another $10,000.
Housing while I'm there, and then an equipment package. You know, you have to have different harnesses, leashes.
Vet bills, food, chew toys, it adds up. The backseat of Sergeant Harrison's squad car had to be torn out and turned into some sort of caged robo-canine insert. Sergeant Harrison took me and another reporter out for a demo of the dog's skills.
What I'll do is I'm going to give him a command to search for human odor.
Body, that's his name, is an imposing-looking animal, but he's friendly too. He's a 3-year-old German Shepherd who weighs 90 pounds. He was born in Slovakia and only responds to check commands.
What I'll do first is just let him kind of free search.
He's trained on 4 scents, methamphetamines, heroin, cocaine, and marijuana. He can detect a lot of other odors too, bullet shell casings, anything a human has touched. When he finds something, in this case a tube of chapstick I had tossed into a field, he lays down suddenly, passive and quiet. This was intentional. Some drug dogs are trained to react aggressively, scratching and pawing, but Sergeant Harrison wanted a more subdued approach because it's much less scary for the unsuspecting public.
Bodie just sat down.
People think, oh, they feed them drugs and they do all this stuff. They don't. They teach them the odor.
Right.
And when he smells whatever odor he's trained in, there's a bunch of odors out there. It's the same thing with an explosive dog. He thinks, hey, there's my Kong ball. There's my toy. That's what I want. He doesn't know that what he's smelling is marijuana or cocaine or methamphetamine.
The idea is that Body will be one more tool local and state police can use as part of a joint effort to fight the spread of drugs. Rockbridge County Sheriff's Department already has 2 canines. Methamphetamine use, in particular, is a growing concern in the county, with more mini-meth labs showing up in vehicles. Body comes at an interesting time for the Buena Vista Police Department. The town is undergoing serious financial strain as a result of a defaulted loan on an unsuccessful golf course for which the city offered up key properties, including the police department, as collateral. The department has been in a state of flux for some time. Officers have left. Morale hasn't exactly been sky high. It's uncertain whether the 16-man force will even stay in the same building if the lender decides to foreclose on the property. The city very recently hired new police chief Keith Hartman, a 23-year veteran of Newport News Police, who commanded a force of 80, to come in and turn things around.
I'm very impressed with the professionalism of the officers. We are short a few bodies that we're trying to replace as quickly as we can. And I think when we get the staffing up, we'll be in pretty good shape. Days off and things like that are tough to come by here right at the moment.
His first order of business, become a state-accredited agency, which he feels will give the department a renewed air of professionalism. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
Since the shootings at Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, the dividing line between people who revere the Confederate battle flag as a symbol of Southern heritage and those who see it as a symbol of oppression and hatred has come into much sharper relief. WMRA's Carol Lofton explored both sides and some nuance in between.
A steady stream of patrons trickled in and out of Dixie Outfitters in Harrisonburg during the hour I spent there on a recent afternoon. The store almost exclusively sells Confederate flag apparel such as bathing suits, T-shirts, underwear, and jewelry. Owner Frank Hill said after the shootings, business has been booming. I asked him why he thought that was.
Some people are afraid that, you know, with everything that's going on and removing the flag from here and there and whatnot, that there may come a time and point that you can't get this flag again.
For Hill, the flag is his livelihood, even his lifeblood. It represents Southern pride, freedom, heritage, and a way of life. It's shocking to him that what he calls one little incident could result in the flag being removed from the license plate and other public spheres.
It's a part of history. I mean, how can one kid change history? Other things have happened in this world and nothing gets changed. Look what Hitler did. You still see a Nazi flag flying, and you can buy it in the United States. You know, it's sad that some people, I agree with this, that some people have used that flag with the wrong intentions and in the wrong ways, but that's been a small minority of them, not the majority of them.
That the flag is a part of history is undisputed. What people now refer to as the Confederate flag was actually the official battle flag of General Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. But while that history means Southern pride for Hill, for others, such as Eastern Mennonite University sophomore Clinton Ubwaja from Gainesville, Virginia,
a Confederate flag is a flag that symbolizes racism to me.
Ubwaja and his friends, fraternal twins Malik and Jerome Jones from Charleston, West Virginia, sat and talked with me for a while about the flag, perceptions, and Southern history. They mostly expressed confusion and talked about what it is like to be young black men in a world where some people still display a symbol that is strongly associated with hatred for people of color.
I mean, I don't see why racism exists. It's kind of hard knowing you're a black man in the world you live in. People around you just don't like you because of your color. It makes no sense. I thought we were past that, and now it just keeps coming up.
So it begs the question, for a symbol that has polarized meanings for two groups of Americans, what is the right way to use it? Is there a right way at all? Malik Jones weighs in.
Southern culture and history kind of just means racism to me. And I believe if you ask most of black people around here, you're going to get kind of the same answer.
At the same time,
I feel like if we did erase it or like make people get rid of it, it would definitely destroy the Southern culture, history, whatever. But I guess it wouldn't be fair to them to do that to them just to make black people happy, I guess.
His preference, though, would be to confine it to historical sites. His twin agreed. Ubwaja did not. He wanted it gone. Grace Hale is the director of the American Studies program at the University of Virginia and specializes in the history of the South. She said the one thing that confuses her the most about the flag is not regional pride or even racism, but the continued use of a symbol that is so painful for a large portion of the population.
One of the things I find really interesting about the heritage people's argument is why don't they pick something else? Right? If what they're very much interested in is a kind of distinctive regional identity, good old boys, country living, family values, why don't they pick something else that's not attached to violence, enslavement of people, the opposite of family values, selling people's family members away from them in the slave trade, which I might add is booming in places like Virginia right up until the Civil War.
For Frank Hill, the owner of Dixie Outfitters, though, the very fact the flag is being challenged may be the reason to dig his heels in and fight to maintain the freedom to fly the flag as high as he wishes. It's part of his cultural history that includes, in his words, separating from the North because the South was tired of being told what to do, and being proud of his own race and history. He claims selling the flag doesn't make him racist, even if others call him that.
You often hear the phrase by people who are pro-Confederate flag that it's heritage, not hate, but the heritage is a heritage of creating, supporting, and extending white supremacy. And I think that it's not inaccurate to call that process hate, but white superiority, white supremacy, as opposed to equal rights for whites and blacks. And that is what the flag has been used for over the last about 150 years.
For WMRA News, I'm Kara Lofton.
If you like, you can see photos of all of the people whose voices you just heard at WMRA.org.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. It's my great pleasure today to introduce you to Orange County resident Bob Brennan, who's been farming for a long time.
I was born in Bridgeport, Connecticut in 1932. I was brought up in Long Hill, which is just a few miles out of Bridgeport. There was small farms there. There were mostly one-horse farms, two-horse farms, dairy farms, and vegetable farms. And ever since I was like 5 years old, people would say to me, what are you going to do when you grow up? I said, I'm going to be a farmer. And I guess I've been a farmer ever since.
All I do is farm, 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 no matter what. Got farming on my mind, I can never get enough.
The first crop I sold was radishes for 25 cents.
How old were you?
I was probably 6 or 7. And then my father bought me 25 chickens and when I was about 7 or 8. And my father liked to drink a little bit too much, so I was responsible for the chickens. Nobody ever bought me a pound of chicken feed. I had to go earn the money picking blackberries or whatever could do to make enough to buy the chicken feed. I ended up with nine hens, nine pullets. And I would hand feed them. What I mean by hand feeding, I gave them warm water in the wintertime in the morning. I gave them warm water at night, and they would stick their head and shake their head, and the water would go all over. And then, but if I had nine chickens, even back then in the wintertime, I would get 7 eggs. So in the springtime, if I had nine chickens, I was getting 9 eggs. So the county agent up in Danbury, he didn't come out and say that I was lying, but he implied that that I wasn't getting them, that number of eggs. So I never sent my egg report in because I didn't need him. I needed to sell the eggs because I needed the money. And then there was a farmer there, Charlie Randall, was a vegetable farmer. So he gave me $1 a day to help plant the vegetables and the potatoes. And all the other kids got 25 cents a day because they didn't work. So I would get 25 cents a day, and then I'd go back and give me 75 more. And he did everything with a pair of Percheron horses. And then there was another old guy there, Mr. Davis, and he was born in 1857. He was 7 years old when Lincoln got shot, and he was about 85. This would have been probably in 1945, probably. He said all the newspapers were full of articles. Everything was about the assassination. So I'm one link away from actually when Lincoln got shot. But we did have a little saddle horse. It wasn't little. It was a big saddle horse. And Charlie harnessed him once for me. And after that, I was on my own. I bought a wagon for $1. and another farmer gave me a harness for free. On my 11th birthday, it was August 11th, 1943, my father gave me $10, and I bought a Guernsey calf. So I went up, I hitched up my horse on my $1 wagon and drove up there. The man's name was Russell Rischel. So he said, well, that was 5 days ago. It's $11 today. He says, I'll be back. So I hook up my horse from the fence, drove him back down home. I had a cigar box in my bank, which I still have. I should have brought it with me today. And I got a dollar out of there and put the calf in a feed bag, let his head stick out, tied it good so he couldn't jump out of the back of the wagon. And I raised the calf out on the... And then I cut the grass on the side of the road with a scythe, pushed it in old man Davis's barn in a wheelbarrow. And he let me keep my calf in his barn. But I had a shovel. He had one horse and one cow. I had to shovel the barn out every morning before school. So that was my rent. I had a lot of time, no money. So then when my uncle was an attorney, bought a little farm down the road. It was 45 acres. And by this time I was 13. And he said, bring all your animals down to my farm. And so I did. Of course, I couldn't jump at that quick enough. And there I was, 13 years old, and he turned me loose on that farm and let me do about anything I wanted. He didn't charge me any rent, but I was his slave on the weekends. So I had a lot of time.
You're smiling when you say that, you know.
And he was good to me. I mean, here's an attorney. What does he need this kid? But you know what? It makes tears come to my eyes thinking about Uncle Fred. So, and he taught me a few things that are still good today that I tell the kids, you know, you'll never be any better than the people you hang out with. He said, listen to them. If you don't like what you hear, move on.
Oh, chicken, you better go to Rooster pretty soon. Chicken, oh, chicken, you better go to roost behind the moon. Chicken, oh, chicken, better go to Rooster pretty soon, 'cause a $10 bill for Shanghai is way too high for me.
Some pictures of Bob Brennan and some links are on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, comes from Bib and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, Joy Loving, Jim and Pam Huggins, an anonymous donor, and a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. You too can contribute to in-depth coverage of issues, events, and people in our community. Find out more about the News and Information Fund at WMRA.org, where you'll also find all of our stories from the newsroom. Like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio to get a heads up on our coverage. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. I'll see you in the morning.